In 1952, physicist George Gamow published a popular level account of Big Bang cosmology under the provocative title, The Creation of the Universe. And just last November, there was a public television special on the same topic and with the identical title presented by journalist Timothy Ferris. And in the past decade, there have been numerous popular books on Big Bang cosmology, and I think it's fair to say that most of these have continued in the tradition of Gamow in employing the words creation and origin to identify the category in which their subject matter is seen to belong. Listen to some titles and subtitles. Steven Weinberg's 1977 landmark book is called The First 3 Minutes, A Modern View of the Origin of the Universe. Astronomer Joseph Silk in 1980 published The Big Bang, to which was given the title, subtitle, The Creation and Evolution of the Universe. And in 1983, Silk teamed with John Barrow to write The Left Hand of Creation, The Origin and Evolution of the Expanding Universe. And in the same year, physicist James Trefel published The Moment of Creation with the subtitle, Big Bang Physics from Before the First Millisecond to the Present Universe. I believe that one of the significant phenomena that these and other writers are illustrating is the modern inclination to place the religious concept of creation and the scientific concept of a Big Bang beginning side by side, to view them as but different forms of the answer to the question, how did we get here? Robert Jastrow has provided us with perhaps the most candid expression of this perspective in his popular book, God and the Astronomers, described on its front cover as a book in which one will find, quote, the riddle of creation explored by the greatest writer on science alive today. That's not a bad billing. Jealousy will get me nowhere, right? In Jastrow's words, now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. Namely, the chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time in a flash of light and energy. End quote. But we now ask, is this really the case? Are the biblical and scientific perspectives identical in their essential elements? And in my judgment, they are definitely not. I'm convinced on the basis of both biblical and scientific considerations that the biblical concept of creation and the scientific concept of a Big Bang beginning have relatively little in common, that they are, in spite of some superficial similarities, concerned with fundamentally different categories of questions about the physical universe. Furthermore, I believe that the Christian community should take the lead in clarifying the meaning of words like creation and origin, and in setting the example for their appropriate and meaningful employment. And here I want to say a public word of thanks to writers such as Conrad Hyers for the meaning of creation, to Charlie Hummel for the Galileo connection, for George Murphy, for the trademark of God. ASA writers have had a good year, and I congratulate them on their contributions. Now, in the second part of this paper, the total of which I cannot read in the time limits, deals with Big Bang cosmology as a picture of formative history. I would first, given more time, make some comments on the restricted domain of scientific cosmology, using the term domain not quite in the same way that Charlie did yesterday, but perhaps I should use the word scope. I'm concerned about the limited range of categories of questions that physical cosmology as a natural science is capable of investigating. And to use terminology common to a person like Tom Torrance, I would say physical cosmology, as all sciences, are restricted to asking and seeking answers to questions concerning the inherent intelligibility of the physical universe. Matters about physical properties, patterns of behavior of matter and material systems, And I would add to that that science, a science such as physical cosmology, is also, I believe, quite capable of meaningfully investigating the formative history of the physical universe. What is excluded from this set of categories are questions concerning the relationship of the physical universe having this inherent intelligibility, the relationship of that universe to the transcendent. For us, the concern is the relationship of this physical universe that we can describe scientifically, the relationship of that to God. Those are ultimate questions that fall outside of the scope or domain of all of the natural sciences, including scientific cosmology. I would then perhaps want to make some comments on the presuppositions of scientific cosmology, but let me summarize it by saying I believe that cosmology operates with precisely the same set of presuppositions as all of the natural sciences, and furthermore, that is as it should be. And I would not be in favor, for example, of trying to build definitions for such approaches as the operation science, origin science distinction that other Christian scholars would seek to build. If I had an extra 20 or 25 minutes, I could give a little summary of the standard model, as it's commonly called, for Big Bang cosmology. But once again, I don't have that luxury. You know, I'm geared to 50 minutes. aren't we all?
Adapt to 20 and you'll become happy.
Only temporarily. Let me make a comment on somewhat a side issue, but a favorite one nonetheless, and that is the Big Bang as metaphor. According to the standard model, the beginning of cosmic history was characterized by the awesomely rapid expansion of an intensely hot plasma of matter and radiation. Within human experience, the only analogous phenomenon to which this singular event might be compared is an enormous explosion. But the explosion analogy and the Big Bang metaphor, however helpful they may be in our attempts to describe something so far beyond our experience, have a misleading connotation. References to explosions and other things that go bang bring to mind scenes of destruction, devastation, and disorder. When the initial episode of cosmic history is referred to as the Big Bang, we quite naturally conjure up the image of a bomb-like event which shatters existing structures and obliterates order. But the Big Bang of which cosmologists speak is not at all like a destructive or disordering explosion. Quite the contrary. The initial rapid expansion of the universe is a constructive process which sets the stage and prepares the players for the historical drama that is to follow. Perhaps the primordial episode should be renamed. Instead of Big Bang, we might call it the grand opening or Act One of the drama of cosmic history. Or to try a different metaphor, the first episode is to be compared not with the boom of a nuclear bomb in wartime, but with the bloom of a flower blossom in springtime. These metaphors may fail to have the dramatic appeal of Big Bang, but they more faithfully convey the idea that coherence, integrity, order, and structure are introduced, not destroyed, by the initial episode of cosmic history. Doubtless the Big Bang metaphor will prevail, but let's be aware that any implication of destruction and disorder must be stripped away. For popularizers of scientific cosmology to overlook this pitfall may be no more than carelessness. But for critics of scientific cosmology to argue that the orderly structures present in this universe could not possibly form as products of the Big Bang is grossly misleading. The Big Bang scenario in itself neither ensures nor prohibits the formation of galaxies or stars or planets or people. The rhetoric which attempts to preclude the possibility of a constructive cosmic history by arguing that the Big Bang is an inherently destructive or disordering event is the rhetoric of misapplied metaphor. The Big Bang metaphor was introduced to convey the idea of rapid development from a singularly hot and dense beginning. But to employ that metaphor in such a way that it gives the appearance of precluding the evolutionary development of ordered structures is carelessly to violate the limits of applicability of an otherwise useful metaphor. And we jump ahead. I say some similar things concerning the rhetoric in the employment of the second law of thermodynamics. In summary, I would conclude that the oft-heard assertion that the universe as presently structured could not have developed from a Big Bang beginning is simply not warranted. Neither the misapplication of the Big Bang metaphor nor the misconstrual of the second law of thermodynamics should be granted the status of adequate argumentation. Christian scholarship is not advanced by such strategies. Then a section on biblical creation as a covenantal doctrine of relationships. Biblical creation as a covenantal doctrine of relationships. When we speak about the biblical doctrine of creation, what specific propositions or statements do we have in mind? As recently pointed out by theologian David Kelsey, what the Christian community in a particular place and era perceives to be the content of creation doctrine is generally a mixture of both metaphysical propositions and statements of a more historical character. Metaphysical propositions on the one hand and statements concerning historical events on the other. Propositions that the universe is intelligible, distinct from God, and radically contingent upon God's existence-giving activity are the fundamental metaphysical components in creation doctrine. But the concept of creation has also been seen by many Christians as entailing an historical claim that the world's existence began in a particular manner at a specific moment in time as the product of a divine act of inception. In our day, for example, the creation-evolution discussion has largely been reduced to a debate concerning whether or when this instantaneous inception event took place. However, as Kelsey argues, the metaphysical claims concerning the world's dependent relationship on God as creator are logically detachable from historical questions concerning the world's inception, formative development, and longevity. Furthermore, the metaphysical propositions concerning the God-mankind-world relationships should be seen as primary and not at all dependent upon particular pictures of the world's formative history, pictures that are unavoidably conditioned by the cultural and historical context. In the course of writing The Fourth Day, and I have to give a plug for yet a fourth book tonight, available at your nearest Logos bookstore tomorrow, I reached a conclusion similar to Kelsey's. My concern was to articulate what the world should look like as viewed through the spectacles of scriptural exegesis. You know, I'm fairly obligated to use a Calvin metaphor wherever possible. More specifically, I was curious to know what we might learn about the sun, moon, and stars through a careful study of the Bible. But before I embarked on that quest, I judged it necessary to deal with a more basic inquiry. To what kinds of questions about sun, moon, and stars might we expect the Bible to provide answers? What categories of questions about the physical world may be appropriately addressed to the Bible? My answer, as developed in the first five chapters of the mentioned book, is that the Bible, when it speaks instructively concerning the physical world, deals principally with questions regarding its status, that is, its place or standing in relationship to God. And along with that fundamental question of status, I might point to related questions concerning origin, in a sense that I'll mention shortly, governance, value, and purpose. All categories of questions that are strongly affected by one's concept of the place of the world in relationship to deity. Now, I don't have time to even give examples of various biblical and theological considerations which led me to that conclusion, so let me move on. The biblically founded doctrine of creation constitutes a powerful statement concerning our status in relationship to God. As the covenantal canon, the Bible opens with forcefully vivid pictures of the creator-creation relationship. But these covenantal pictures, portrayed in the medium of creation narratives appropriate to ancient Near Eastern religious literature, ought never to be treated as if they were highly compressed technical accounts written to provide answers to questions occasioned by modern natural science. Questions regarding the details or duration of creation's formative history, for instance, are not at all relevant to the agenda of Genesis 1. It would therefore be wholly inappropriate to address them to this majestic picture of the creator-creation relationship, and doing so would distract one from its principal message and would likely generate nonsense answers in the process. Let me close with a couple of disclaimers, basically of the character of what physical cosmology as a natural science is not capable of doing. The first, as a scientific theory, the concept of cosmic evolution, including the idea of a Big Bang beginning, does not entail a particular specification of the status of the universe in relationship to God. If the biblical doctrine of creation is principally a statement concerning the status of the world in relationship to God, and if, on the other hand, scientific cosmology is principally concerned with, perhaps exclusively concerned with, a reconstruction of the physical formative history of the universe, then there's no way in which we can equate the concept of Big Bang beginning with the biblical concept of creation. They are dealing with very different categories of questions. One, a set of questions concerning inherent intelligibility, the other, questions concerning relationship to God. And second one that I will mention and then we'll close, as a scientific concept, Big Bang cosmology does not provide an explanation for the origin of the universe. A little explanation. Much of the material written about contemporary cosmology, particularly the type of material that I mentioned at the opening, popular material, speaks of modern cosmological theories as being about the origin of the cosmos. But the reader must be alert to the diversity of meanings given to that term origin. When we speak about the origin of the sun, or the origin of the earth, or the origin of the Grand Canyon, we're using the term origin to represent the processes by which these specific structures were formed. And thus, I wish we would get in the habit of using the word formation instead. It would be so much less confusing. When we ask about the origin of the entire universe, however, we are using the term origin in a different and far more profound way. In that case, we're not asking merely about the formation of its structures, but we're asking the ultimate question of cosmogenesis: what is the source or cause for the existence of the whole cosmos? We're not asking how things were formed, but why there exists something rather than nothing. Furthermore, this question concerning the origin for the existence of the cosmos is a question not only of beginnings, it's just as much a question of continuation, just as much a question about this moment right now. In conclusion, the terms creation and origin are rich with biblically derived theological meaning and must therefore be employed thoughtfully. To use these terms as labels to characterize the subject matter of Big Bang cosmology would constitute a denial of that theological richness and would provide encouragement for all manner of ill-formulated debates that only becloud the issue. Surely we Christians should set the example in our thoughtful employment of these crucial terms in the vocabulary of our faith. 20 minutes. Did you see that, Charlie?
Yes.
I don't know about you, but I felt rushed. but I'd be happy to entertain comments and questions as you have them. Yes, sir.
Would you care to comment at all on Alan Dix's inflationary theory and the modifications of the Big Bang and his nucleation out of a false vacuum and that business? And Paul Davis has claimed a lot about using that to counteract Jastrow's argument.
I really am not prepared to speak to the details of those theories, but I would make the comment that I would insist that in spite of what details they might employ, they are still theories concerning specifics of a formative history model, and thus still do not get at the metaphysical question concerning the source of existence of that which behaves according to a particular scenario, a particular formative history. So we can talk details all we like, but we're still talking about the particulars of a formative history. We are not yet even close to the question of source or cause for existence of that which behaves that way. Yes.
Argues along the same line, and I think it certainly makes sense theologically, especially from a Calvinist point of view. But I'm still kind of not satisfied, because there's certain unique things about that cosmic beginning event, fact that it was the only event in history that encompassed all of creation in one moment, and also the fact that prior to that event, everything is undefined physically. We don't know whether there was anything prior to that event or not.
And it's even difficult to talk with the word prior, because time itself is a component of this physical universe.
Exactly, because time stopped at the beginning in terms of the relativity. So does that still kind of trouble you, those considerations, that this was somehow a unique event that's different from other events, ordinary events?
I guess I'd have to say it does not trouble me, but I've been working for a long time, I guess, to avoid making the word, or allowing the word creation, to be a concept associated only with beginning. I want the word creation to, as a word related to God's activity, to apply equally to every moment of cosmic history. It includes, if you will, inception, preservation, governance, and providence. That's in my vocabulary. And so in seeking to avoid a concept of creation which raises one moment of cosmic history above all the rest is something that I have worked hard to avoid. And thus, doing that for some time, I've become comfortable with that. And thus, in a more glib moment, I might say, the first moment is no more impressive to me than any other moment. To put it more positively, each moment of creation's history is equally impressive to me. Okay.
In other words, the opposite of what goes with creator is creature, not artifact.
Okay. A creature continually dependent upon the creator, and that's the kind of relationship that is captured by the word creation as a label for a doctrine. Switch over to this side. Yes, sir.
What is intelligibility, and how can you define it without using some variety of word relationships?
Okay. By intelligibility, we ordinarily mean, there's some sense that we can make out of it. Okay, we can make some sense of the world in which we live and of which we are a part. It does have some intelligibility. Now, much of its intelligibility is of the sort that is resident within the properties, behavior patterns, and the like of the physical universe itself. It's that component of the world's intelligibility that the natural sciences have access to, whatever can be, in a sense, gleaned from looking at the parts and how they function. Now, we might argue that there's other intelligibility concerning the physical universe if we include the matter of relationship to deity. I mean, that relationship is intelligible too, perhaps principally via revelation concerning the character of that relationship. But in talking about the inherent intelligibility as that which natural science has access to, I'm limiting the intelligibility to that which is resident within the properties, behavior, and historical development itself. You want to follow up on that?
It seems to me that in your answer you substituted the word sense for intelligibility. So I ask you to define that.
Maybe without being terribly formal. I wanted to use, I mean, intelligibility in the way that I'm using it is the quality that we are able to make sense out of it, or that sense can be made out of it by our investigation. I'm going to go way to the back now.
I have a question in regard to what you're saying from scriptural exegesis and what the people were looking for. It seems to me that, and I don't think we're necessarily putting it, but I see no reason why they shouldn't be asking the question, how did it begin, just as we are asking it? And the answer to that is, in the beginning, God. And that seems that, I presume you're not going to say they couldn't have been asking that question.
I don't know.
Okay.
Right. And in the beginning, God is an answer to the question who and from what source. But that's not, of course, the kind of beginning that is the subject of physical cosmology, and it's that distinction between the different questions related to beginning treated by biblical doctrine on the one hand and physical cosmology on the other. We'll get a couple minutes. Yes, sir.
God said, let there be light, and I'm willing to equate that to radiation. And the Big Bang Theory apparently starts, I understand, with an incomprehensible concentration of radiation gradually being converted to matter. Mm-hmm. And then added to that is that the light is characteristic of presence in the work of God.
Or as a symbol.
But in thinking of those two matters as related to my alpha being?
All I can give you is my opinion on that. I cannot answer that definitively, of course. Now, I would put that in the category of superficial coincidence, that in the early part of the Genesis 1 narrative, we find a reference to light. And in the early stages of a Big Bang cosmological scenario, we also find a radiation-dominated phase. I would call that a superficial coincidence, and because I don't think that questions concerning the radiation-dominated character of the early universe was at all the subject matter of Genesis 1, not then and not now.
Thank you.
Dave.
If you had to place the Big Bang in a sort of a perspective as far as verses, would you associate with Genesis 1:1 or with some later verses in chapter
1? No. No, it's that kind of attempt at correlation which I do not count as directing appropriate questions to the Genesis 1 account or the rest of the scripture. We may differ on that point, but that's how I would answer your question.
That's a very happy comment I wish to end, because I happen to agree with you.
While I introduce you, do you want to get into your regalia? Not that your present one doesn't suffice.
Okay. That goes around your neck, and if you had a tie, that would be the tie question.
Okay, well.
As the program notes, our next speaker is George Murphy, whose sermon I will not say we appreciated, but which spoke to us so forcefully this morning. He has been a professor of physics, most recently in that capacity in West Australia. He's been called into the pastoral ministry and is now currently the pastor of St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Talmadge, Ohio. As you can see, he has a very long title, and I'll let him pronounce the words.
The relevant part of the title is The Paradox of Mediated Ex Nihilo Creation. And I will... Is that my fault? Now you won't be able to hear me. St. Thomas Aquinas said something that I think is well to bear in mind for a lot of things that the ASA is concerned with, and particularly dealing with creation. They hold a plainly false opinion who say that in regard to the truth of religion, it does not matter what a man thinks about the creation as long as he has the correct opinion concerning God. An error concerning the creation ends as false thinking about God. Two fundamental ideas about God's creative work, God's way with the world, stand in a very fundamental paradoxical tension. My purpose here is not to try to resolve that paradox. I don't think that is the way theology works. That seems to be an essential part of the operation. One thinks, for example, of Luther's characterization of the Christian as simultaneously justified and sinner. Instead of any resolution of that, my goal here is rather a highlighting of these two fundamental ideas about the doctrine of creation. That is, the doctrine that creation, God's work, is creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, and that in general, God's creative work is mediated. That is, that God works through means rather than directly. And I want to primarily give some examples of places where both of those ideas have to be paid attention to. First of all, what does the concept of creation ex nihilo mean? Fundamentally, it means that God called the world into being entirely by God's power and God's will, without any cooperation or anything other than God, without any pre-existing matter or anything of that sort, and that God sustains the world entirely on that same basis through God's will and God's power, that finite being exists entirely because God wishes for it to exist. Now, as Howard has emphasized, the relevance of that doctrine of creation does not end with creation in the beginning. And in fact, the emphasis in the Bible tends to be more on what God is doing now. And I think that is brought out very well in Luther's Small Catechism, when he explains the first article, "I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth." What does this mean? "I believe that God has created me and all that exists. He has given me and still preserves my body and soul with all their powers. He provides me with food and clothing, home and family, daily work, and all that I need from day to day. God also protects me in time of danger and guards me from every evil. All this he does out of fatherly love and divine goodness and mercy, though I do not deserve it." Now that is creation. It is creation ex nihilo, because it is done entirely because God chooses to do it, without any human merit. But it is clear, on the other hand, that that is not an unmediated creation. That is, God does not provide clothing and family and shoes and all these things, clearly, by pulling them out of a vacuum. God creates them, provides them mediately. That is, through the means of the processes of growing of plants and social structures and chemistry and all the things that go into that. God's work is mediated in that case. Fundamental theological understanding is that God's work comes entirely from God. But it is also fundamental understanding that God's creation is good, God's creation is intelligible, and consequently, that it is possible for us to understand the causal chain of events through which God brings about this work. I think it's important to remember that there's not just a possibility of theological confusion, there's a possibility of merely logical conclusion here, because people tend to think that events can only have one cause. And I was reminded of this particularly when one of our local homosexual apologists wrote a letter to the local newspaper about the AIDS crisis that contained the phrase, "Homosexual behavior does not cause AIDS, a virus causes AIDS." Now, this is, of course, rather like saying Abraham Lincoln was not killed by John Wilkes Booth, he was killed by a piece of lead. That is, there's certainly more than one kind of cause, and to say that one thing is the cause is not to exclude anything else. One has to bear that in mind. Okay, creation out of nothing, but creation which is mediated, brought about through means. It's the kind of paradox I was talking about, and I'd like to look at some examples of that. First of all, what has already been referred to, the question of creation in the beginning. And while we may agree, well, certainly God the Creator is still active today, there's a temptation to say, but God, in the beginning, whenever that was, 15 billion years ago or whatever, God did something different. Then God really created. And I think that's kind of temptation that Howard is referring to. Now, certainly it is true that something different happened 15 billion years ago from what is going on now, and there's no point in trying to deny that. However, the fact that God's work now in providing clothing and family and all the things that Luther mentions is mediated at least suggests to us that we ought to be able to consider God's work of creation in the beginning as something that is mediated. And that, in fact, is the direction in which modern cosmology seems to be going. We're going back beyond the point simply of talking about the first 3 minutes. We had the question asking about the inflationary universe and developments of that sort. There are papers in the last few years in which cosmologists attempt to explain the creation, that is, the creation of the material of the universe, the mass energy of the universe, by a process of quantum tunneling out of a state which they describe as nothing, that is, a state which has no space-time. And so in some very real sense, that is creation out of nothing, creation of the material of the universe. And if you wonder how that can happen, and although this is not a complete explanation of the physical theory, I just point out to you that if you have a system of particles that are interacting with one another gravitationally, they have positive kinetic energy, they've got negative potential energy, you can certainly think of a situation in which the total energy is zero, and in which, consequently, the creation of particles by the process of pair creation can take place with no violation of the law of conservation of energy. Now, the real process is a good deal more complex than that, but that gives, I think, some kind of suggestion as to how that comes about. Consequently, matter itself can be created in a way that is mediated by known physical processes, because the known laws of physics would remain valid. And in fact, it is those laws of physics which make possible the creation of matter. And I think that that forces us to realize, as I have suggested before, and as Jim Neidhart's paper yesterday again suggested, that we have to regard the laws of physics themselves as in part the object of God's creative work. In at least a somewhat Platonic fashion, but I think I will not take time to pursue that further now. Concern with creation in the beginning, of course, also introduces the questions about the origin of life. Not only origin of matter, but where did life come from? Scripture also teaches, and I've emphasized this in my book, which Howard was kind enough to give a plug for, and some other places, Scripture teaches, and the general understanding of the early church fathers for at least 1,000 years in Genesis 1 was that God's creation of life is mediated creation. God says, let the waters bring forth, let the earth bring forth living creatures. And the understanding of people like St. Basil and St. Gregory of Nyssa and people like that was the understanding of mediated creation. That is, God is not simply creating all different species, popping them out of the vacuum, as is kind of popularly suggested sometimes, but somehow the material of the universe is, God created the material of the universe in such a way that when God wills it, it can bring forth life. And that, of course, I don't need to remind you, is very similar, not at all to say that that Genesis 1 teaches biological evolution, but that concept of mediated creation is, of course, very consistent with the understanding that biological evolution suggests of the way in which life originates from non-living material and the way in which species develop from other species.
Okay, I want to move on, though, from the question of creation in the beginning and look at some things that are happening now. I think one thing that is of interest here is a question, God's work that we are often concerned with and often include in our prayers, the question of God's work of healing. That's something that you often see in the newspapers. You often see articles about some case in which parents don't want their child to have medical treatment because they believe he ought to be healed by prayer or something of this sort, and these cases get into the courts, and I'm sure you've seen things of that sort, or questions of religious freedom and things of that kind are raised. Found very helpful here a passage that I came across in an old German prayer handbook of Johannes Stark, early 18th century, work of German pietism. He has lots of prayers for the people who are sick, and they include little exhortations and homilies with them. One is that is the exhortation before the patient prays on taking medicine. I think this is very interesting, the way this idea of mediated creation comes about. Stark says, if a devout prayer is indispensable even in times of health, how can a patient neglect it, particularly when he takes medicine? The patient must not despise the physician nor his medicine, nor think that if he is destined to recover, God can restore him without medicine, and that if he is destined to die, the medicine will be of no avail. No, to think thus were to tempt God. God has not promised to help us without means, and what God has not promised, we cannot ask of him. Those who despise medicine and die are guilty of their own murder. Yet, he must not set his trust upon the physician and his medicine, but upon God, as it is declared to be one of the sins of King Asa, that in his sickness he did not seek God but the physicians and trusted them more than God, in 2 Chronicles 16. Between these two extremes, the patient must select the golden mean. With his lips and his heart he must pray and take the medicine in firm reliance upon the helping hand of God. Then he may know that there is a blessing upon it. In other words, the Christian and the unbeliever will take the same medicine and may be healed in the same way. One of them sees God the Creator at work in all these processes of medical care. The other person doesn't. One of them has faith, the other doesn't. And that is what distinguishes between the Christian and non-Christian response to that situation. It's not that the Christian, you see, thinks of God as some extra process along with medicine and doctors and whatever else there may be, but that God is working precisely through those means. And really, to despise those processes, to think that faith ought to be able to do without them, is to deny the goodness and the validity of creation. Well, now, can't God heal miraculously? Well, of course God can heal miraculously. Maybe even when any way that we can see, any natural means that we can see, that simply doesn't exist. But the basic question is not what God might do, but the way in which God works in the vast majority of cases. And in that great majority of cases, people who are healed immediately. I'm afraid that in some quarters of the church, there is an unfortunate tendency to overemphasize the miraculous as if only direct interference could show God's activity. And that shows up, for example, unfortunately, in things like the Living Bible, and in which the word for sign in the Gospel of John, semeion, which is sign, is rendered as miracle throughout. And that simply is not correct. Miracles, and a miracle may be a sign, but all signs are not miraculous. And in fact, it's really only faith that sees in any sign, whether it's miraculous or not, God to whom the sign is supposed to point. If they will not believe Moses and the prophets, etc. You know how that goes. Just in passing, let me say, I'm not going to go into great detail on this, but some of you will remember an article in the ASA Journal a few years ago which aroused some controversy dealing with the virgin birth about 2 years ago. in which it was argued that one can at least envision possible biological processes through which the virgin birth could have occurred, virginal conception, I should be more precise, the virginal conception of Jesus could have occurred by natural processes. Now, whether that is biologically correct, I'm not prepared to say. Whether that's the way it happened, I don't know. But I would just simply say that that is theologically quite sound to at least pursue that kind of possibility. Well, perhaps sufficient for that. Briefly, I'm sure I'll get some questions on that. Briefly, two other points, and then I will, well, three other points, and I will open this up for questions. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that while I have been talking about creation, that the mediated character of God's work, that God works through instruments, is not just something that refers to creation, is not just a first article concern, but is a general property of God's activity. That God's work of redemption and sanctification also come about mediately, through means, through the incarnation, through the preaching of the gospel, through the sacrament. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that while I have been talking about creation, that the mediated character of God's work, that God works through instruments, is not just something that refers to creation, is not just a first article concern, but is a general property of God's activity. That God's work of redemption and sanctification also come about mediately, through means, through the incarnation, through the preaching of the gospel, through the sacraments. They do not occur, again, miraculously, at least in the way God usually works, miraculously without any kind of instrumentality. Okay, again, two other things briefly. I think what the general point that I've been making is of some significance when we consider a much debated question, that is the question of the source of God's revelation in Scripture and the inspiration of Scripture. Again, there is a tendency to think that if scholars say there are certain sources for the Bible, certain written sources, oral tradition, various things like this, that therefore there is a denial of the inspiration of Scripture. And I would say that if one considers the mediated character of God's creative work, you realize that that simply is not true. God can inspire Scripture, not by putting the words of Scripture directly into a writer's mind, but through processes that an ordinary historian would recognize as the sources by which writers get their information, documents, oral tradition, records, and things of that sort. So that, for example, if a writer says that the doctrine of the resurrection comes into Jewish thought from Persian sources, and that some people would say that, that is not saying the doctrine of the resurrection is not somehow come through divine inspiration. It's simply that God, again, works mediately through that particular channel. Final point. Talked about the preservation of God's creation. One of the very important places where that is of concern is, of course, the issues of war and peace today, because we now have technology which, at least in our limited part of the universe, seem to make possible the destruction of the created order with nuclear weaponry. God's intention for the world is certainly peace. It is the biblical shalom. It is something that is more than simply the absence of people blowing one another up. And that is the goal of God's creative work. God intends peace. But again, in the kind of situation that we have in the world today, is peace going to be brought about by God intervening directly to stop wars, defuse nuclear warheads, or whatever? Again, I think the biblical picture does not suggest this, and that is precisely what the Christian tradition means, or has meant, a large part of the Christian tradition, in formulating the just war tradition, in saying that in some instances,
weapons and warfare may be the means, the instrumentality, by which a larger peace can be brought about. Now again, it should be understood, as it always has to be emphasized there, that the just war tradition does not mean any kind of wars at all are okay. It means there are very specific criteria for that. But again, I think that understanding even things like weapon systems and fighting can be the instrumentality by which the work of the preservation of creation is carried out. Part of the task, I think, let me say in conclusion on that note, as scientists and as Christians, is not looking for direct intervention by God to solve that kind of problem of the world, but to exercise more human imagination in finding better instruments by which peace can be brought about. I think, for example, of the proposal by James Burnham of the introduction of approximately 1,000 U.S. and Soviet observers into one another's strategic system with complete access to everything, research, development, and all that sort of business. As a means that is perhaps more imaginative than simply the threat to blow one another up. One of the great features of creation is imagination. Russian theologian said God created the world by imagination. And it is incumbent upon us as those who are called to exercise dominion over the creation in God's image to exercise our imagination as well. Covered many topics. This is very much, I recognize this is very much as simply skimming over a number of different things which are at least, I hope, at least tenuously held together. Be glad to look at any questions you may have. Yes?
Firstly, how do you actually use the term mediated with respect to the creation of Adam and Eve? Versus, I mean, the language, the biblical language is different than, for example, in the first chapter of Genesis, where, like, the water came forth.
Specific statement, like, let the earth bring forth, is not there in the first creation account.
In
the first creation account, it's just let us make humanity in our image. It doesn't say, let the earth bring forth human beings. The second one, I think Dr. Hyers pointed out yesterday, I mean, it's very much God created humanity from the dust.
Right.
You know, is very much that kind of instrumentality there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how would you, it seems more direct rather than mediated.
Well, it's not mediated in the sense of there being some long chain of events pictured there that bring about humanity, but still it is not a direct thing in the sense of just humanity being caused to appear. Yes? Well, punctuated equilibrium is still gradual. I mean, it's just, it's irregular in its rate.
Very irregular.
Yeah.
It creates an entire organism path.
Well, I don't think that's what somebody like Stephen Gould means by punctuated equilibrium. Well, okay, I would say, first of all, I don't mean to limit this in the sense of saying God can't do these things. What I'm looking at is what does the Christian tradition say and what does Scripture say about the way God, in fact, does work in general. You know, one point I won't bring that up. That's getting too far afield. But
No, it's not a matter of saying God couldn't do something else, but how, in fact, does God work?
What's the definition of the word chiasmic?
Chiasmic is, that comes from the phrase that in Plato that is quoted by Justin Martyr, in which he says that God placed the Logos crosswise in the universe, a chiasin, placed him like an X. And Justin understood that as a prophecy of the cross, which is a rather naive view, but I think it's a rather nice picture, and the idea of the cross being placed, Christ being placed crosswise in the universe. That is, the way Christ, the way God is seen in the universe is, in fact, in the cross, and of which creation out of nothing is the same kind of thing. Part of the reason why I did not talk about that is because it goes too far afield to explain that, and I probably would have been wise not to include that in my title. Yes, Howard.
Perhaps the distinction between mediated and non-mediated creative activities could be made by employing two metaphors. The magic metaphor for non-mediated, and the kingly, the sovereign king metaphor for the mediated creation. And the biblical metaphor is predominantly God the creator as sovereign king who issues the decree and the subject, that is the whole creation, responds to the decree. Mm-hmm. Whereas within the Christian community, I think we have far too much employment of a magic metaphor for the creator in place of the more biblical kingly metaphor.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think, as I said, The early church fathers did not do that. I mean, they tended to emphasize the mediated character of creation. And I think it's interesting, even though we do not believe in spontaneous generation in the sense of flies being born from horse manure and mice from old rags and things like that, I think the fact that many generations of Christian theologians could accept that things like that happened without any theological problem is an indication of the fact that there really was that sense of the mediated character of the way life came about. Yes?
Yeah, I'm thinking about this idea that God created ex nihilo, but also per verbum, and the God's word.
Yeah.
In a sense of mediation. There's a lot of puzzle about the term mediator. You know, we know that Christ is the only mediator between God and man, but Christ is God.
Okay.
Now, the things that you talked about as being mediators are all creatures.
Yeah.
Do you see in a way that before there were any creatures, there could have been, that in some way there is some mediator that's in between God and man, and God and the creation to be?
Well, as I said, I did not really refer very much here to the to incarnational ideas. In one sense, the thing that plays that role is in a sense the laws of physics.
Well, the laws of physics are creatures too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And which is the difference between this and a strictly Platonic idea in which the laws of physics exist alongside God. Yeah. Yeah, I think we're running out of time here.
Comment on your ex nihilo in the Darwinian Centennial at the University of Chicago in 1959. I took five of my doctoral people down from Northwestern to sit in on it. And there was a debate, the war between science and theology, with three theologians and three scientists. And after 2 hours, the scientists said, if you'll give up ex nihilo, we'll accept creatio. And the theologian says, we'll stick by creatio and let you have ex nihilo for the Big Bang. And Harlow Shapley said, after all, from the scientific point of view, chemistry tells us of what the universe is composed. Biology and physics tell us how it works, but only theology tells us why it's here and how to live it.
Well, and I see, I think
that's an illustration.
Yeah, I know theologians who say, well, we should give up on ex nihilo, and I think that comes from a misunderstanding of ex nihilo. Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
third speaker is John Haas. He is professor of chemistry at Gordon College. And he's going to speak to us on Christianity and the Rise of Science, a reappraisal. Too bad Professor Hugas isn't here.
Touche. A couple of announcements. First of all, I have not written a book. But I'm going to review one. And secondly, I'm going to start with the 20th century instead of way back there in the beginnings. But anyway, and I do thank you all for coming. It must be still raining, otherwise they'd be out in the lawn by now. Those of us who were privileged to attend the Oxford conference last year will remember that the plenary session dealt with the radical critique of science. And one of the features of this critique involved some of the new interpretations of history of science as it relates to the role of Christianity in the development of science. You may remember papers by Colin Russell and David Livingston and Paul Marsden, which will ultimately appear in the ASA Journal. And they dealt primarily with the some 19th and 20th century issues. I would like to extend some of their discussion this evening. And first of all, I'd like to talk a little bit about the field, the general field of history of science, especially the role of Christianity, and then maybe look at some of the topics of current interest in this extremely important and I think currently very active field. And perhaps, if I'm lucky, I'll never get to the scientific revolution. First of all, the history of science. It's fascinating in itself. It's a relatively old field. You may remember that Francis Bacon had some rather trenchant comments about those who had gone on before. More recently, Georges Sarton, the Belgian, perhaps would be considered as the modern pioneer in the field in he established ISIS. People like Charles Thorndike wrote monumental works in the field. And I.B. Cohen and others followed him into the present. As a field of study, the history of science really started out with primarily amateurs, people who were in other fields who just happened to write in history of science. The initial formal programs started in the 1940s and the 1950s. I guess I.B. Cohen was the first person to get a PhD in the thing, and it was quite a hassle at Harvard and to get that program started. J.B. Conant, a chemist who became president, sort of weaseled the thing in, and they started a program. Well, after that, the field was extended, programs in Oxford and Cambridge, and then many institutions around this country. It became present in universities, and many schools now have programs related to the history of science. I suspect one of the problems now is where do these people get jobs once they've gotten their degrees, but I understand they're doing all right, at least the present. Now, who are the historians of science? They're really a mixed bag of people. Some of them have just been general historians with an interest in history. Others are science dropouts, usually people in their elder period of their life who decided to get out of science and start meddling. Theologians, sociologists, bad news. Philosophers, more bad news. Physicians, and scientists who still are doing sciences. Today, it's estimated that more than 50% of the papers that are published in the journals, history of science journals, are more than 50% of them are done by what they call amateurs. And that's a bad word to some of the historians of science. And there's much variety and difference of quality in the kind of stuff you read these days. I think it was Butterfield's Origins of Modern Science that was sort of a pivotal book in the field. Now, he was just a historian, British historian, general historian, but he wrote that book at just an opportune time. What was it, in the late 40s, early 50s? At that point, most of the people in history of science were writing arcane monographs about some telescope somewhere. He wrote this general interpretive essay, which just really pulled a lot of things together and evoked a lot of interest. And so it was the generalist who really, I think, instilled a lot of interest in the field, and it's still a good and influential book today. And just as an aside, I think here's a place for people like us who may not be a specialist in a field, but if we can draw periods together with a reasonable interpretation, I think there's a spot for us as amateurs. Now, there has been a range of historiography. Now, what in the world do I mean by that? That's about as easy to define as the word science. But I think a historian probably would like to suggest that historiography is really the way historians work. The kinds of materials they use, the kinds of documents, and the kinds of interpretations they use, and many more things as well. Well, historians of science have used many different approaches through the years. The inductive approach, the great men approach, no women evidently, the positivist approach, and then there was Kuhn, and the continuity-discontinuity approach, and on, the Marxist approaches. Perhaps today, many of the historians of science, and many historians in general, use some sort of a contextual approach, where they try to look at the period in history in terms of what the people at that time understood, not from the way we look at it in the 20th century, but where the people were at that time, not to critique them in 20th century terms, but to see what they knew back then. And I think one of the things that has come out of this is that the science, the development of science through these many generations, has been influenced by many, many social factors. Science did not just develop on its own, and that some of these social factors included the various religions and, of course, Christianity. This is one field where I'm impressed where professionals are really willing to describe the role of Christianity in something without apology. Now, that's not to say that there's not bias, that there's not controversy, and that there's not passion. I think in terms of the ASA Journal, there have been no more emotional issues that have arisen over the years than some of those dealing with history of science. And the ASA letters to the editor sometimes are quite flaming. But it's fun. All right, what about the role of Christianity in science? Perhaps the earliest tradition went along sort of this way, that by the 18th century, science had reached maturity, and that later 19th and 20th century science was free of theological, philosophical, or political assumptions or implications. And from an earlier state of timid independence or subservience to theologians and philosophers, the splendid autonomy of modern science was achieved. A little later tradition was that of John Draper and A.D. White, perhaps around 1900, where you had the warfare idea, science and Christianity in great conflict. Well, beyond that, in more recent years, people like Pierre Duhem and Burt and Merton and Courier and Westwall and Raven and Butterfield have modified that tradition, that concept, quite a bit. And then in very recent years, people like Koikas and Clarin and Yockey and Lindbergh have written in the area, and many, many articles continue to appear in ISIS and Journal of the History of Ideas, and perhaps 300 more journals that publish materials in this area, and of course in our own Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation. Two of the earlier motifs were that of warfare and essentiality. And I think if you remember back in some of the writings that we've had in the journal, you'll see those kinds of issues raised to some extent. I think the more modern, I better not use the word more modern, but I think in terms of the professionals in the field, they would rather see a long set of complex relationships between Christian faith and the emerging science. Some of them were positive, some of them were negative. And they would suggest, and I think I would agree, that it's very dangerous to hang your hat on one interpretation or another. People just can't be evaluated, and especially scientists can't be evaluated that narrowly to make some generalized statement that doesn't end up being trivial. Well, what are some of the current areas of interest among historians of science who deal with Christianity's influence? Well, in the 20th century, there's a lot of interest in such movements as the creationist movement. The ASA, I understand another PhD thesis is about to be started on simply the history of the ASA. People are still looking at Lynn White's assertion about the role of the Puritans' Christianity in the destruction of nature, so-called. Some people are looking into the roots of how current people are integrating Christianity and science, trying to see those roots in history. People are interested in the Scopes trials and many of the other trials that are going on. How the philosophers view and have viewed Christianity in the history of science. In fact, beware of people with tape recorders. Oral history is very much in fashion, and if someone comes around with a mic and a set of very tricky questions, watch out. Speak in Spanish or softly or something, because it will happen. I've been doing it myself, so anyway. So, a lot of interest in the 20th century. History just does not deal with Beowulf. Well, how about the 19th century? Well, we're certainly well aware of a number of issues that have been addressed recently. This warfare idea, just a couple comments on this. The warfare, in terms of a number of people, has been seen to be less science versus Christianity than a number of things. First of all, maybe just simply conflicts between believers and unbelievers who happen to be scientists. So it wasn't science and Christianity, it's just belief and unbelief. Secondly, often a battle of ideas among individuals. Thirdly, a conflict between competing scientific systems, one relating to the Bible as a scientific system, two, science as a scientific system. And maybe also a struggle between groups of professionals for top billing. Who might they be? The men of the cloth and the scientists. And remember, the men in the cloth used to be on top, but in the 19th century they started to get second billing, perhaps. Well, you're well aware of James Moore's post-Darwinian controversies, and his view that some of the debate back then wasn't nearly what we have thought it has been. Earth history, another 19th century interest. Rudwick is an example of those who feel that the geologists early on managed to stay away from debates about age and so on, simply by putting barriers with their discipline, putting up walls and just saying, let's talk about geology. We've got to make it a professional field. Let's stay out of mosaic types of interpretation. And they managed to do that for a long while in the last century. They did have their problems, obviously, toward the end and today. Well, medicine is another fascinating field that hasn't really been too developed, at least the way I've been able to. The religious opposition to medical science, medical advances in general, dissection, use of cadavers in medical education, inoculation, pharmaceuticals, etc. I think there's some examples here that parallel Galileo. We have a quaint tradition in Massachusetts that when you're having a burial ceremony, that the clergyman has to stay there until the grave has been filled, stemming from an ancient law dealing with the problem that the boys from Harvard used to rip off cadavers. That's true. We're very serious about that. All right, the 18th century. The Enlightenment, right? Remember your history? The beauty of history of science is it brings all culture together. That's what makes it so much fun. All those courses you took in college really come and give you, fit together. All right, well, the 18th century. There's a vast literature in the history of this century, but not very much on science and science and Christianity. There's a lot of work to be done there. The French, the British, and the Germans really developed differently. The Germans managed to stay fairly theological, the pietism that was mentioned a little later. The French went way off the mark quite early. British ended up deists of one sort or another, and you could hardly get much religion out of their Newton's work by the end of it. But the German pietists managed to keep Christianity. They fought to keep it and deliberately kept it. It's interesting to look at how that was done. Well, I'm probably not going to be able to say much at all here about the scientific revolution. What I would like to do is talk a little bit about a book which contains a good discussion of the scientific revolution. It's a new work that came out, God and Nature, Historical Essays on the Encounter Between Christianity and Science. The University of California Press, relatively expensive little paperback, probably close to $20, depending on what kind of a discount you can finagle. And it's edited by David Lindberg and Ronald Numbers, two historians of science at the University of Wisconsin. And in this work, we find 18 essays by professionals in the field on areas in history of science and the relationship of Christianity, ranging from science in the early church all the way down to Protestant theology and natural science in the 20th century, and modern physics and Christian faith and the creationists. It came out of a conference in 1981 at Wisconsin by the professionals who wanted to give a really definitive, at least in terms of a modern literature, view of what the professionals thought about the history of science. I think this book certainly will disagree with some of the views that some of us hold here. It's not perfectly done by any means, whatever the word perfect means in history anyway. We're always going to disagree, but I think it gives a reasonably balanced view. And I feel in many ways that this should be the starting point, other than with Charlie's book and a few other works that are around, for a serious study of history of science. I think it's really a watershed book, and one that you really have to have if you're going to know what the modern view is. It is a great starting point, however, for more work, and work by people of ASA ilk. I think that in understanding science, we have a leg up, perhaps, on a sociologist who hasn't done science, or a philosopher who's talking about science. It's difficult to talk about history of science. There's so many dimensions to it, and I think that we can contribute. The one thing I would encourage us all to do is do our homework. As scientists, we go back, we look at the literature, we look at our data. But sometimes, as historians, we just might start off with a bias. It's a very noble bias, but that noble bias can really end up being relatively unacceptable by anyone who looks at the data. And I think we serve the cause of Christ by doing our work well and wherever it leads us. So I really would encourage you to get involved in history of science and to read with critical eyes what you see written about history of science. Thank you. Have I been vague enough so I'm not going to get any?
You may not have escaped.
All right. Well, it's late. Great.
I have a question.
All right, Charlie.
A few years ago, there were a series of books that were trying to portray the idea that the Reformation produced science. I've seen a lot of other people sort of reacting against that idea, saying, no, it had a long history long before that. And can you think of books that would delineate the idea I'm going to have with it? That rather than one causing the other, that rather Christianity was the common thread that affected both the Renaissance or the Reformation and the development of science.
I'm not sure I'm ready yet to give my answer to that. I think, and it would take too long anyway, I think this book discusses the various issues. Pierre Duhem, physicist, French physicist, thermodynamicist, I think started off a serious discussion on that. Not everyone agreed with him at the time, and maybe he overstated a number of things. He had the continuity thing, that really there was no such thing as a scientific revolution. In fact, before you have to talk, when you talk about the rise of science, you have to decide whether there was a scientific revolution, first of all, that Christianity could have helped. I mean, and when you get into that 17th century England, you have to decide whether it was the Puritans or the Anglicans, what was that, latitudinarian Anglicans, you know, wishy-washy Anglicans. But or it was simply that religion had finally left science, so now the scientists could do it. And I mean, there are so many different interpretations. You really pick what you want right now. It's simply impossible to define the Puritans, the Anglicans, and the walking around people. And at least Galileo, he wasn't, too much of a Puritan. And so he gets a lot of difficulties. And I'm kidding here because I want you to know it's a hard subject, discussed reasonably well in this book, Charlie. And you come to an opinion after you read it, okay? And that's really what I want to say. I shouldn't try to be authoritative any more than you guys were about the creation of the universe. Yeah, Larry. Larry. Put him on the defensive, right? Yeah, Larry.
I find a common theme that
in looking at history of science, many Christians wish to show that in particular Christians were responsible, or a Christian worldview helped promulgate science, because science is respected in our day and we want to attain some of that respectability. That's one possible motive. You know, I'm wondering if we're not making what I consider the same mistake in trying, that creationists make, in trying to point to phenomena and say, because we can't explain it, God must have done it. And in this case, we're just saying, because it hung around with Christianity, God must have done it, and this proves, in a sense, Christianity. Do you see that as some sort of mistake in that way?
That motive may well be there, and also lie in the sort of mindset that likes to prove God, you know, proofs of God and so on. And I don't want to put down that approach. I find it difficult myself, but maybe it's my Calvinism, and yet I see it as being part of that. I guess I'd like to think we don't have to prove God, and we don't have to use these shifty arguments, and the boys with the cosmology here didn't want to say this way or that way. Because if this way or that way go down the tubes, what happened to God? Well, anyway, yeah.
Jack, in regard to that same question, I think it's a terrible mistake. All scientists today are Christians, or all scientists aren't Christians, and it probably was just as true 100 years ago.
200 or 300, they all were something Christian.
You can make the point for some individual.
But they didn't want anybody to know it, because they were all preachers. Oh, yeah. And it's not good business for preachers to be atheists.
And to try to get a convert to combine all of them.
Yeah.
I know certainly there's a number of individuals.
Right.
I don't know whether...
excuse me.
I'm talking about the article in the AFA Journal, and I'm very sorry that I can't remember the only one's name that wrote it in regard to the contribution.
Yeah, Sarah.
One of my problems these days is how people get names.
Well, it's the same as yours. That's even worse.
I thought she had a very good argument for the effect of the Calvinist doctrine on the Calvinist doctrine, which is Christian doctrine,
friend. Yes, brother. We're letting it all hang out tonight. Yeah, are there any other good questions?
It was a credit to God, desire to discover new things. We see this today. I think this is students. Well, I'm going to be perfectly satisfied with a B. I just want to get enough to get through. And I try to challenge them that it's, you know, God expects more of them than that. He expects them to use their minds to the best of their ability, and that can glorify God.
Exactly.
Some scientists felt that way. Many others probably
didn't. Yeah, Jack.
I found in my classes that I get onto the subject you're talking about whether science is compatible with Christianity, is a reaction to what I think is still in our society, that there's a warfare between science and Christianity. And you can certainly say, well, science grew up in a Christian culture, so they can't be all that incompatible. Not that you're trying to prove something by it, but you're trying to disprove the concept of the warfare between the two.
Right? That's right. And I think the historians of science have really shown that Draper and White just overkilled that idea. I think that's a positive contribution. I don't think any of us or any of these people will deny that Christianity was very much related, intimately related with the rise of science, starting with the time of Christ to the present. But exactly what that is the question. But nobody's denying that anymore. The positive's gone away. Science did not develop in a vacuum. It developed in a social environment where there were people and motivations, et cetera, et cetera. The Marxists actually were the first ones to help us out into that idea. And Weber and the rest of them.
Well,
it's
time to quit.